This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SubChina. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, founder of the Commander Companion Graded Reader Series, and there's only one thing worse than leaving someone in suspense. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and always gives 100% unless it's blood. What does it take to pursue a degree in Chinese in China? With our resident expert John Pasden, we'll pull back the curtain to show you what it takes for a non-Chinese person to get admitted into an all-Chinese university program and what it's like. Interviews with Tom Connolly, a multilingual worldwide adventurer who is channeling his passion into teaching others the Chinese language. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, I'm John Pasden and I am in Shanghai, China. Hi everybody.
Okay, Johnny, before we kick into our subject today, we do have a number of reviews, and this has come from some emails we've received from listeners. So first off, it comes from Chris. And Chris says, hey guys, discovered the podcast. Really great listening and thanks for sharing your thoughts on learning Chinese. Quick question. I'm around HSK 4 level at present, and I can recognize about 1,000 or so characters. On this basis of your selection of books, is there a particular one you'd recommend? Many thanks, Chris. Well, Chris, our level 2 only goes up to about 450 characters, but there are some other graded reader series out there which do go a little higher, and I would recommend that you might check out. Check out Imagine 8 Press. That's at Imagine 8 with like the letter 8. Sorry, with the number 8. And they have a bunch of books. It's called Rise of the Monkey King. They're going to be a little bit closer to that level there. So you might want to, those are some great ones, and I feel comfortable recommending them. I know the guys are behind it, and they do a great job.
Yeah, so good luck, Chris. There are plenty of other options. All right, so I have a letter from Adeniki, and I'm just going to skip right to the question. Adeniki asks, how would you recommend I go about improving my reading? I got a physical copy of My Teacher is a Martian. I'm planning on getting the audio version, so maybe listening and reading along might help. What do you think? Keep it up. You guys are a blast. And also, thanks for bringing in some of my favorite podcasters, Jeremy Goldcorn, Kaiser Guo, and Laszlo from CHP. Cheers. You're welcome. Okay, so to answer your question, how would we recommend you go about improving your reading? We actually did a whole series on this. It's called How to Learn to Read Chinese, and it's a four-part series, but we actually later added in another part. So these are episode numbers 46, 47, then 59, then 48 and 49. It's a whole series.
All right, so check that out. That's definitely going to get you to where you want to be and help answer that question, because it's not a short question, is it, John?
Yeah, we have plenty to say on that topic, so take your time there. Jared, do we have any other ones?
We have one last email, and it's from Alex Deva, and he says, hey guys, thanks for your work for the Mandarin Companion books, All Set Learning Grammar Wiki, and of course, the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. I'm the type of student you mention often, learning outside of class, outside of China with a tutor and lots of different types of individual tools. Can't tell you how helpful your work has been to me. The books have given me much-needed self-confidence, and the podcast has taught me a whole lot of do's and don'ts. My question is, when during the long and arduous process of learning Chinese, is it a good time to also take on another language? And as a follow-up question, should this new language be similar to Chinese or as different as possible? Case in point, I started learning Czech. I'm still in love with it, but have arrived at the nightmare called Czech adjectives. I decided to do something totally different and so went for Chinese. Is that a terrible idea? Best, Alex Deva. Well, John, what do you think about that?
I think it's impossible to answer that question. If you really like it and you have time for it, then go for it. If you're doing it for no reason and you don't really have time, then it's probably a bad idea. So there's lots of range in between those two states, right?
And there definitely is. And, you know, I think it can help if there are some similarities between the languages. That is sometimes what can make Chinese a little bit challenging because it is unlike many of the, I guess, Latin-based languages that many of these listeners come from. But, you know, I don't really know the similarities, if there are really any, between Czech and Chinese. I think they're probably very different. But, you know, I think ultimately this comes down to your motivation. If it's you find it energizing and you find it something that's, you know, energy creating for you as opposed to like a drag and something that's just slogging you down, then yeah, go ahead. If you're feeling that synergy or that you've seen that kind of boost of motivation. If you're not, if it's kind of becoming that drag and you're just like, oh, arduous torture or whatever, you might want to rethink, maybe going off those two languages at the same time.
But learning a new language definitely helps your brain with plasticity because every new language requires you to think in new ways. And so I think it's good for your brain. Like I myself keep returning to Chinese Sign Language. I'm not great at it, but I know a bit. And it's just fun to learn. And deaf people in China are super happy when they find out you can speak sign language, you know, their sign language. So, it's great. Go for it.
Okay, well, today we are going to talk about graduate studies in China. So, I mean, let's be clear about this. So, maybe you've graduated with a degree from university or uni or college or wherever you are, and maybe now you've been studying Chinese and you want to pursue a graduate degree and you want to study in China. Well, we have someone who knows quite a bit about this, and he's on the show with us today. Welcome, John Pasden. Hey, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, all right. So, this is going to be an interesting topic because there are really few non-Chinese individuals who have gone through graduate school in China. And so, I think we're going to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit, right, John? And let us know some of the nitty-gritties of what goes on there. Because you're not the only one who's done it. And I'm sure you'd also know some other people. And our guest today on the podcast is also going through this as well. So, it's going to be kind of fun to talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, you say there are a few, and that's true if you look at absolute numbers, but there are actually more and more. And to be clear, if you want to get a graduate degree like a master's or a PhD, there are programs in English in China that you can do without fluency in Chinese, any degree of fluency. But what we're talking about today are the programs that require you to be fluent enough in Chinese to be able to handle all the work, you know, write your papers, write your thesis, all entirely in Chinese. So you would have Chinese classmates. But a lot of programs in China now do have, you know, like maybe one or two foreigners in every class. Because remember, these are people from all over the world. They're, you know, Africans, Russians, Indians, people from all over studying university in China.
And, you know, it's interesting you point that out, John, because I actually am quite familiar with the English-speaking graduate programs. Those are largely business programs, and I've been involved in graduate business education all over the world when I did my MBA at Purdue. But, so let's get into this. So, John, how about this? How about you tell us first, like, why did you and why would an individual decide to say, hey, I'm going to go get a graduate degree in Chinese at a Chinese university?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think there are some majors where it doesn't really make sense to get a master's in China, like, English, if you're American or you're British or Australian or whatever, why would you go to China for an English degree? All right, obvious. Mm-hmm. But then there are some that make a lot more sense. Things like Chinese linguistics, that's what I did, Chinese language teaching, Chinese history, Chinese literature, maybe Chinese cinema or business specifically related to China. So for those, it does make sense to study in China. Now, that doesn't mean that China is the absolute best place to study. So, for example, things like Chinese language teaching, a lot of the foremost scholars in the field of Chinese language teaching are not in China. They're in the U.S. And other parts of the world. And, abroad, the programs are quite advanced in things like language pedagogy. And in China, a lot of times the instruction is a bit more, traditional. So it's a bit different.
Yes.
It's a bit different. But clearly, if your topic is Chinese China, then China is a good place to study for certain reasons. So it really depends on what you're going after and why you want to get the master's or the PhD in the first place.
So I think this is a good question. I mean, specifically speaking to your own motivations, John, why did you do it? I mean, you could have gone and done, Chinese linguistics. I don't know. Could you have done Chinese linguistics anywhere else other than China?
Yeah, for sure. I was looking at programs in California and other places. I was originally planning to leave China to do my master's I did want to do a master's in second language acquisition, you know, applied linguistics for a while. But I eventually came around to the idea of doing it in China for a couple reasons. One, I was just having too much fun in China, learning Chinese. I really enjoyed my life here. I didn't want to leave. Two, at one point, I forget exactly how far along I was in my decision-making process for graduate school programs, but I met my future wife. And so that played a factor. And then number three, I just thought long and hard about what are the pros and cons of studying something like this in China versus studying outside of China. And I just felt pretty confident that I could learn some of the knowledge that I would get in a U.S.-based program just by reading on my own, things like corpus linguistics that I was interested in. And a lot of the things that I could learn about in China, I really couldn't learn about abroad. So some of these things include, like, what is the Chinese educational system actually like for, you know, master's programs that Chinese teachers take? Like, a lot of people don't really know what a Chinese teacher learns if they have a master's in second language acquisition. But actually, I do now because I did it. I studied a master's at East China Normal University in China, which has a pretty good program in the Chinese department. And so I actually know what the program is like, what is required of all the students, you know, what the classrooms are like and all that. And so that's something that's cool, that it's not book knowledge. And I could really only get if I did it myself in China.
Okay, so let's say you have that interest and someone listening here, hey, I have this goal one day to go do this, or I'm actually planning on it now, or I'm just curious about it. Okay, so how do you actually do this? All right, because I have been through some, I guess, Chinese educational system registrations before getting my kids into local Chinese schools, and it was a little bit unclear and murky and arduous a little bit. But how does a foreigner go ahead and apply for a graduate program in China? And I imagine there's going to be some special requirements for such individuals.
All right, so I'm not going to get into too many details because I did this in like 2005, 2006, and I think it's changed a bit. But one of the major things, obviously, is a language requirement. And we, when we talk about the HSK, we say how it's not necessarily the greatest measure of your Chinese, you know, proficiency. But if you want to study in a undergrad or graduate level program in China, you do have to take the HSK. Mm-hmm. And so you can take it in your home country, you can take it in China. But I was actually researching this because I didn't know. But currently, using the 2012 HSK, which is going to be replaced soon, but using the current HSK, the requirement varies from school to school. So some schools only require an HSK-4 for undergrad, maybe HSK-5 for graduate school. Some prestigious universities have higher requirements. For example, Peking University, Beijing Daxue, they require an HSK-6 for undergrad and graduate. But Tsinghua, one of the other best, you know, schools in Beijing, only requires a 5, HSK-5 for graduate. So it's around an HSK-5 that you should expect to need, sometimes only HSK-4 if you want to do graduate level studies in China. Sometimes they also require what's called the HSKK, which is the Kouyu, the spoken Chinese degree, which is like an optional additional part of the HSK. So back when I did it in 2005, 2006, I did need to pass the HSK. It was the old HSK that I took, but I had that score. And I also
You did take the HSK.
The old HSK. I'm old school.
But there was that handwritten, like, you know, the right characters by hand?
Yes.
Ooh, that was hardcore. Not online.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
In fact, it was the handwriting. That was the reason that I didn't get like a super high score. The handwriting kind of screwed me.
Sure.
But I got a good enough score. So
evidently.
To get into the master's program, I also had to demonstrate knowledge of linguistics because I was going straight to graduate level studies in applied linguistics. Did I know anything about linguistics? I had to prove that. And in order to do that, I had to demonstrate knowledge of just modern Chinese, you know, the linguistic features of modern Chinese, the kind of stuff that you learn as an undergrad in China if you're studying Chinese or linguistics, that kind of thing.
So, John, did you have to, like, study for this? Did you have to take, you know, an exam or test or something to show that you contain this knowledge?
Yeah, so I had to take a multiple-part essay test. There was an essay
delightful.
On. Yeah, there was like so this is a handwritten Chinese character test, right?
Ooh,
and
yes.
I had to write basically 2 full pages of Chinese in like, I don't know, certain time limit, 2 hours or something. Maybe it was 3 full pages. I can't remember. But it was questions about like, kind of social science type questions, just showing my ability to argue a point. And then there were the technical questions about the Chinese language itself. And in order to prep for that, all the linguistic questions about the Chinese language, I had to study for a year. I hired a tutor and went through the textbook that Chinese students learn. They learn from in school about, you know, Chinese linguistics. And then I just practiced writing, practiced.
Ooh,
so
man.
I just wrote essay after essay. And I actually learned a lot from that, even though I don't write much anymore. What I learned is that writing is a skill that you can build up, and then you can let it fade, and you can build it back up when you need it. So I actually became much more comfortable with letting myself get a bit rusty at writing, because if I don't need it, then I'd rather spend my time on other things. But if I ever do need it, I can always get it back.
You know, I think anyone listening here, if you've been listening to other podcasts, we usually poo-poo on, you know, taking the time to really learn how to write characters. And, you know, keep in mind that John did that, right? You had to spend that time repetitively writing characters hundreds, even thousands of times. And that's the time it takes to learn how to handwrite fluently. And so most people, unless you're going to go into this graduate program, stuff like this, it's probably not going to be a skill you're going to use.
Yeah, so I didn't spend time writing individual characters hundreds of times, but I did write lots of short essays and, you know, kept forgetting that one character over and over until I finally stopped forgetting it. And I improved my handwriting at the same time. But here's the thing. They had that written exam requirement to get into the program to prove my knowledge. I think I got like an 87 or something. It was okay. But after that, I never had to handwrite for the entire 3 years of the program again.
There's another case in point about taking the time to learn to handwrite, and then you're in a graduate program, and then you still don't need to handwrite, right? It was just like an entrance requirement.
Yeah.
Certainly, were you taking notes in class? Like, you know, I assume you were using characters if you're doing notes in class, things like that.
Yeah, so I did do that.
So there you go. Okay, so it can come in handy a little bit. So this is great. So I think anyone, you know, this is going to be like if you're going to apply to med school or biology, there's going to be like prerequisites. So I think the same vein here is that if you're going to be into this graduate program, they're going to need prerequisites. So it's within the sense of like saying, all right, you have a high enough level of Chinese and perhaps, you know, knowledge of the subject matter before you're getting into here. Because this is the one thing we do know at graduate programs is that it's not just about rote memorization, about learning. It's more about understanding concepts, application, and analysis. So it's kind of sometimes focused on a higher level of thinking. And so I can see why these assessments are going to be important, you know, saying, hey, are you ready for the program?
Yeah, and another thing is that foreigners really do get special treatment. Like, it really depends on the school. So, for example, Beijing University, I think they're not quite as forgiving as some universities. But a lot of universities, they see it as prestigious to have foreigners in their programs, and so they want you to get in, and they're not gonna like do anything to prevent you from passing. They might kind of help you in some cases. Really depends on the school and the program. But and I'm not just talking about like white people. They want people from all countries, you know, Japanese, Korean, you know, Russian, Middle Eastern, you know, African. They want all these people in their programs. So they're not going to make it harder than they have to, but of course they need some standards. So I have seen some cases where it seemed like people really shouldn't have gotten in, but they did. This was a while ago. And especially when it comes to East Asians, like Koreans and Japanese, they tend to have very good reading and writing, but not very good speaking skills. So some Chinese programs are even very forgiving about that. Like, you can't really participate in class very well and your accent is atrocious, but you're reading the readings, you're submitting your papers, and it's all fine, so they'll let it go. In my case, it was kind of the opposite. When they met with me and they talked to me, they felt like my spoken Chinese was quite fluent, if not terribly sophisticated. But if I could demonstrate with the written test that I could actually put a few sentences together with characters, then they wanted me in the program. And so fortunately, that worked out.
So I also will note that I am aware there are some other programs that are sometimes geared towards specific countries. For example, where you don't need to know Chinese at the beginning. I know Jiao Tong University had a medical program where they would admit you to medical school and you'd be trained to be a doctor. And the idea was the first year was in English with heavy Chinese instruction, and then afterwards it's all in Chinese. It's really difficult for anyone. I've known actually a number of people in that, and the attrition dropout rate after second, third year is actually pretty dang high because it gets hard fast, and they're not very forgiving because it's a medical program and you need to know your stuff. But there are some things like that. That one was mostly geared towards African and Middle Eastern countries, but you may find these types of programs. So, John, you know, you did your master's degree then in China, but what do you think were that trade-offs? Because you could have done this in America, and what did you think you gave up by going to China, and maybe what did you gain by doing it in China?
So I do feel like when it comes to cutting-edge research in the field of linguistics, the U.S. is the place to be. You know, we also frequently talk about Paul Nation. He's from New Zealand. So China has certain niches in the field of linguistics that, you know, related to Chinese, but I did feel a bit of a lack of that cutting edge research, but also the atmosphere of the classroom in China. I'm not sure this is terribly fair, so I want to preface it with that statement, but I have heard things like Chinese undergrad programs are a lot like high school and graduate school programs are a lot like undergrad programs, where they don't require a whole lot of independent work, independent thought, and just, you know, actively researching and doing stuff. And I gotta say, in my program, I did feel some of that. There were some classes where, you know, the teacher kind of does a lecture every class. You have your assigned readings, but not much is required of you other than attending and sitting there and then submitting a paper at the end of the semester. Unfortunately, from what I've come to understand, that's pretty common in a lot of Chinese programs. Now, not all programs and not all classes within those programs are like that. Like, for example, there was one standout class in my 3 years, or actually 2 years of actual classes, coursework. It was called I can't remember the Chinese name or the English name, but it was basically selected works from Western linguistics. Something like that. And that class was different because that teacher, I think maybe she had studied in the West. She definitely liked France. But anyway, that teacher had us do presentations. And that one probably required the most of me. And it was in my first semester, which was a bit unfortunate because I was still getting used to, like, you know, handling this high level input. It took about a semester to get used to it, but this is when I had that hardest class. And so I had to do a presentation. And fortunately, I was given a linguist which wrote his works in English. So I was given Noam Chomsky. And I had to research his original, like, most famous work, the one that made the biggest splash. It was called Syntactic Structures. But I originally only had to do one chapter, but I decided, because I felt like my spoken Chinese at this level was kind of bad, I would just, like, do the whole book. And I would do extra work to kind of show off, because I can easily read the original in English, and then I can study all the terms in Chinese, and I can give my classmates a fuller overview of what Chomsky was trying to say. So I have to admit, it probably wasn't my most fluent presentation in Chinese, but it turned out okay. I got an okay grade, and it was a great learning experience. And so that was probably the exception for most of my classes. There are a few that were okay, but yeah.
All right, so John, tell me something about, like, you know, studying there that was, like, really, I guess, unique, maybe culturally wise, that you wouldn't have encountered in the United States.
Okay, so I mentioned already that students don't tend to be so active in class, like participating in discussion. But one thing that I thought was really interesting, and I can't give names here because I don't want to incriminate anybody, but at the very beginning of my studies, I think it was the first semester, maybe the second semester, some of the teachers in the Chinese language department approached me, and they're like, "So we know you've done some teaching before and you're American. Can you give us English lessons?" And at the time, I was like, oh, man, I got a lot going on. I don't really want to do this, but I didn't think that was a good idea. So I agreed to do it. And, you know, they said they'd pay me. It was a very modest amount, but they said they'd pay me. So, okay. So I did my best. I taught them some English. They were good students. Didn't forge any great friendships, but I met the teachers in the department. And after one semester, they were kind of busy, so it kind of just ended there. What I didn't expect was that a semester later, one of those teachers taught one of the courses that I had to take. And This was a course that conflicted with the work I was doing, you know, earning money. And I wasn't sure how to handle it, but the teacher was like, hey, I really appreciate how you taught us English before. I know that you have a pretty good grasp of this stuff, so you don't actually have to come. Just make sure you do the work, do the readings, and it's fine. And I was like, what?
So, the Guanxi, right?
Yeah, that was like, for me, the prototypical Guanxi experience in China. And it only happened that one time. I don't think anything else like that happened. They definitely didn't go easy on me for my thesis defense. But that was really nice at the time, I got to say.
Well, that's pretty funny, John. Well, if you could do it over again, I mean, would you take that same path?
Yeah, I would. I definitely learned a lot. And I wasn't just learning book knowledge, right? I was learning about Chinese culture. I also made a really good friend in my graduate studies. So yeah, it's a path that you kind of want to know what you're doing. It's not just, you know, A or B. You're getting exactly the same thing. They're pretty different. But I'm glad I did it.
Well, John, this is great to hear. You know, some of this insider perspective of graduate programs there in China. And I think it's going to be great as well, because the interview is going to be with Tom Connolly, who is also going through the experience right now of a graduate program in China.
Yeah, Tom is focused on teaching Chinese, so his is a little bit different, besides just being closer to the present. But yeah, I think that'll definitely be interesting for everybody. And don't worry, future episodes are not going to be quite so high level. So we hope you enjoyed this one, if you do have the advanced Chinese or if you're just interested.
All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Chinese Grammar Wiki, brought to you by All Set Learning. So this is a free online resource. Just go to resources.allsetlearning.com and you can get to the Chinese Grammar Wiki. We've got all the grammar points you could need in Chinese, divided by level, modularized, broken down, and easy to read English explanations. And we also have a page dedicated to Mandarin Companion graded readers and all the grammar points contained in those books.
That's right. So if you're going through one of the Mandarin Companion books and you're running across a grammar point or something that you're not so clear about, go check out the Chinese Grammar Wiki. You can find the book. You can actually find the specific grammar point for that part of the book, and you can learn it and be illuminated.
And if you've never noticed, if you flip to the back of your Mandarin Companion graded reader, there is a list of grammar points. And that list of grammar points matches what's on the Chinese Grammar Wiki. So you can find it in either place. Okay, so the Chinese Grammar Wiki, again, is online at resources.allsetlearning.com. Check it out.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you got for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
Well, being my optimistic, positive self, I have a rave yet again, Jared. It's kind of a weird one. My wife recently joined Costco in China, which is kind of weird. They have a lot of like American products. And so is this a rave about American products? No, it is not. Because the thing that our family has found is the greatest product in Costco here in Shanghai are the blueberries. And these blueberries, these blueberries come from Yunnan, southern China. These are the most amazing blueberries I have ever eaten in my life. So good job, China. You know how to do blueberries. And now I know where to get them. That's my rating.
I am surprised, John. I am actually a huge fan of berries, specifically blueberries. So if China ever opens up again and I can come back, then you better make sure you got some for me.
We'll see, Jared. They don't last long. We'll see. All right, Jared, so do you got a rant or a rave for us?
I've got a rave. I got a rave, John. This is something I've gotten a few emails about from some various Chinese teachers, and this is to all those people out there who are doing summer reading groups or summer reading programs. So I don't have any specifics because it's actually like individual teachers are doing them. But yeah, a lot of teachers right now, because you know they just out of COVID, everyone's going online, and now we're into summer, and you know usually people aren't meeting or going to school during summer. But a lot of these teachers are doing like these summer reading groups using like our graded readers, which is pretty dang cool. So I do know there's a teacher in Chicago who I've been in touch with. We have one out there in Iowa. I know some teachers here in Utah who are doing it. And so it's pretty cool. So, and I also, I guess I got to get a little plug, John, you do have those reading programs through All Set Learning, right?
Yeah. If your teacher actually wants to take a break this summer, then you can find one-on-one courses that cover our books on allsetlearning.com. But man, that's amazing. Like teachers, they work so hard. They have a summer vacation, which they have, you know, really earned this vacation. And then they're like, what am I going to do? I'm going to teach more.
That's right. That's right. I even got an email from a reader who he's got a group of, I guess, friends or people who are learning Chinese together, and they're doing like a reading group. And they've been doing this kind of consistently using the graded readers. So that's a great thing. I've been super happy to see that and excited. If you want to do something like that, you know, we're happy to support you. We have a lot of activities and stuff that we can recommend for people who are doing reading groups using the graded readers. It doesn't even have to be our graded readers. I mean, you just finding a book. Think of it like a book club. You know, you get together and you talk about the book. So the same type of a thing, except, you know, you can throw some activities in there and it's a little more, it's obviously focused on Chinese and something that you guys can read. So it's super effective. And I was just really happy to see that. And so it's just an idea as well to anyone who, if they want to try to pull something off like that this summer.
Awesome. All right. So time for the interview, right?
Yeah, but you better get to reading, John.
All right.
My name is Tom Connolly, and you need to know that I'm an American. I'm living over here in China, in Nanjing, and I'm studying for a master's degree in teaching Chinese as a second language.
From Africa to Asia, Tom has lived around the world, but his love for the Chinese language has captivated his focus. Tom has some great stories to share, including the differences of learning an African tribal language versus Chinese. Stay with us. Tom, why did you start learning Chinese?
I went to China in 2014 to become an English teacher, and I realized that if I didn't speak Chinese, I was going to get nowhere in the culture. And
okay, but wait, Tom, why did you even come to China then?
That's also opening up a big box there. I love adventure, and when I graduated from college, I joined the Peace Corps, and I went to Benin in West Africa, right between Nigeria and Togo. And after I went to the Peace Corps, and I had a great experience, and I just kind of got a taste of world exploration. And after I finished the Peace Corps, I wasn't so sure what I wanted to do, and I talked to some friends, and they said, well, why don't you just go to China and teach English, and you can continue to explore, and it's such a big country, you can travel. And so I said, all right, sign me up. So then I applied and was accepted into a program to teach in Jilin, which is in the northeast part of the country. I was up there teaching English, and I was at a university, which a lot of people do, and I was told that if I wanted to take classes with the other international students that came to learn Chinese from all over the world, I could study with them for free. I said, oh, wow.
So that's a perk of being an instructor there at the university.
Yeah. Right? I said, okay, why not? So then I just started studying and teaching. It worked out really well. And then that allowed me to enter into the culture, make a lot of friends, and feel like, you know, I could go out and at least walk around and buy the things I needed to buy and know what I was eating, you know, because I could start to read and pick up a few things, because without Chinese up in Jilin, I really felt like I was pretty much just kind of like a big kid, you know? You just don't really know what's going on, but you're an adult, you know? You're just kind of like, oh, just only what you can perceive with your sight, you know?
Tell us a little bit what it was like up there.
So I was in Jilin province in the Jilin city, which is the second biggest city in the province. So while it's, you know, the second biggest city, it's only probably about 3 million or so.
Only 3 million.
Yeah, only. And there really weren't, and there still aren't, that many people who really speak English well up there. You know, of course, there's some English and people can speak English. But, you know, I've been to Shanghai, I've been to Beijing, you know. I feel like I can almost get around with English in those big cities. But up there, I didn't really feel like that. So I really felt like it was essential. And I had a couple really good teachers. And they were the ones that really helped me. And they told me, you know, like, if you want to learn Chinese, the best way to do it is just start talking to people. So when you're on the bus and you see someone playing with their phone, just say, hey, you're playing with your phone. Or, hey, where are you going? Hey, you just got on the bus, you know, and then just try to start some conversations.
How did your Chinese progress?
So it took me about a year, I felt, before I could really communicate and get around and totally feel like comfortable, not just doing the basics, doing more than the basics. About after a half a year, I felt like I could do the basics. And then after a whole year, I felt like I could, you know, get around, travel, get on the subway in a foreign city in Beijing, you know, or take the high-speed rail to someplace in China. And what did I do to study? Gosh. Well, at first, I tried to learn Chinese by only writing, like, my own pinyin system. So hearing and then writing down what I thought I heard, because that's how I learned an African language.
What language was that?
That was called Dendi. D-E-N-D-I. So that's the language I learned in Peace Corps in Benin. Yeah, so I learned that language basically just by writing down notes and then what I heard, just taking the vowels and the consonants and the sounds and writing them down and becoming words. So I thought I could do that for Chinese, but Chinese is a little bit more sophisticated, a little more complicated with the tones and just the complex vocabulary.
I'm actually really interested to hear a little bit about this compared to Chinese. I mean, how far did you get in a year with Dendi versus how far you got in a year with Chinese?
That's a great question. Dendi was so much harder to learn than Chinese, even though it's a less even though it's a less complicated language, because I had no real resources. I mean, I had one language workbook from the Peace Corps that they had typed up and given to the volunteers for this language. It was just so much harder because there was so little access to resources. You know, in Chinese, 2014, everyone already had smartphones, internet. I mean, you could just type in what you heard on Playco, and then the word comes up, and it's got a nice English translation. So, you know, learning Dendi basically was just a lot of point, tell, speak, and then make sure what I'm pointing to, they're comprehending, and that's what I want to know. You know, that kind of real basic. So I think what I learned in 1 year of Chinese, it took me more than 2 years, at least 2 years, if not more, to learn that same amount in Dendi. Because I stayed in the Peace Corps for about 4 years. I did two terms in Peace Corps. And I felt like after 2 years in Peace Corps, I was finally able to do more than just say, hi, I'm hungry, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So Chinese, although much harder, the language picked up quicker because of the resources.
That's great. And I think that's something that a lot of times us learners of Chinese, we may lament over the difficulty of the language and the tones and all that stuff. But yeah, I have encountered in some of my associations with other people who are learning like Czech or they're learning Romanian or things like this. And these languages don't have the resources to learn. But yeah, we got that in Chinese despite the difficulty.
For sure.
Well, all right. So you were doing this up in Jilin and, you know, all right, you're making some progress. But I mean, obviously, you decided to kind of keep going with Chinese. So what happened next with you?
So I ended up in Beijing because I love to do outdoor recreation. And I started doing outdoor activities, outdoor recreation, and combined that with education. And it was my job. So like teaching outdoor skills to both adults and children. And it was still somewhat English-based and some done in Chinese, but it was basically what we call outdoor adventure tourism and education. So I found a company and I started working for them, and it was a Chinese company. And it was a lot of fun. I worked for them for about 2 years, and we did a lot of things. I got to go on a trip to Tanzania with the company to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. I got to go all over China to do kids' outdoor sports activities, you know, taking kids camping, hiking, rock climbing, these kinds of things. And I was using Chinese and English at the same time.
Was it like one of these things where it's like, oh, you're going to be learning English while you're doing this, right?
Exactly. So you get your exercise, you've got the American English teacher, and you're, you know, exploring and traveling at the same time. And I was hoping it would become more with adults and I could do more like hardcore mountaineering or outdoor adventure tourism. But it started to become a lot more of just like working with kids. And I do like working with kids, but it was, I hate to say this, but you know, like just babysitting.
I've been on a lot of campouts with kids. I know what you mean.
So I decided that probably wasn't my life calling. And actually, I made a big decision. So I was in Beijing. You know, everyone's like, oh, you're in Beijing, good city. There's so many opportunities. Sure, you can find something to do. But I decided actually to leave Beijing and go back to Jilin. So I went back. So like, you know, you're going from like New York to Pittsburgh, you know, like you're going from the big city where everything's happening, where everything's at your fingertips. And then you're going back to like the iron steel country where everything's cold and, you know, manufacturing, you know.
In my experience there in China, it's hard to get people to move down the tiers of cities, right? Once you can move up like third tier to second tier, they're not going back down, right? So that is a big, that is, you know, I guess unique, right?
Yeah. But the reason I did that is because when I was teaching up in Jilin, I was also taking classes, right? And I noticed that there were few students in those classes I was taking. And by that time, my Chinese had gotten much better. And I knew that if I went back there and I took the upper level classes, there would be maybe just a handful of students in my classes with me. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I stayed in Beijing and went to Beijing Language and Culture University, there would be, you know, maybe 20 to 40 students per classroom. So I made the big move. I said, I'm going to go back to a place where I know my living expenses are going to be much cheaper. It's maybe a little bit inconvenient getting around, but it's a small city, so things are easier nonetheless. And I know that I'm going to have more chances to interact and work with teachers because there's just going to be few students. So I went back, and lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. You know, I was in the high level of Chinese classes, and I was with 5 students.
Oh, wow. Wow. What was that experience like?
It was great because there I was, you know, 30 plus years old, maybe 32 at the time. And I'm with undergrad students from South Korea and Mongolia. And they're young, you know, they're 21, 22. And so they're coming to class sometimes, sometimes not coming to class. And I'm the one like sitting right in the front row, right in front of the teacher, always raising my hand, always asking questions. And I got the nickname of, you know, the king of questions. And I met one teacher, Mr. Zhao. And Mr. Zhao Ju really changed everything because he taught me how to learn Chinese.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about that.
First of all, he wasn't so quick in doing everything. You know, he went through things very methodically, very methodically. And he said to me, he said, you know what? You've got a good level of Chinese. You can speak, you can listen, you can understand. But there's a lot more to that. And there's more in reading, and then you're eventually going to need to improve your writing. He said, if you want to really improve, I got to teach you a system. I got to teach you how to learn systematically Chinese. So I said, all right, what's your system? His system actually became a lot of learning Chinese grammar. Like, what's a subject? What's a verb? What's the difference between a verb and a predicate? You know, what are these things you know in even my own native language, English? You know, like adverbs, adjectives, pronouns. Like, you know these things, but do you really know them because you learned them in grade school? So he started to teach me these things, and then he started to teach me this complex vocabulary and what they're associated with in words, and then how to use them and how to apply them when you're learning Chinese. For example, this is a noun. Everyone knows a dog, a cat, a person, place, or thing, right? Okay, in English, a noun is usually the subject. But in, you know, in Chinese, the noun also can become the predicate, you know, and it can also become the subject. He taught me things like that. He has a clean system for learning the parts of speech and then learning what kind of function those parts of speech can be in Chinese. And when I started learning this, I said to him, I didn't say it. I said to myself, this guy's crazy. I don't need to learn this. I just need to learn to speak. You know, Chinese is already good, right? And I stuck with it. We started slowly and steadily accumulating this vocabulary because you can read it, but do you really know it? Have you really digested it? You know, so I started learning parts of speech and then what function those parts of speech have. And he taught me how to use the dictionary, you know, a real Chinese dictionary, learning Chinese from Chinese, the Xiandai Hanyu Cidian, the modern Chinese dictionary. With those two things, you know, learning the parts of speech and then what function they have, and then learning how to use the dictionary, he basically gave me a system that I've been able to use today to learn Chinese. It seems basic, like, oh, you just learn the parts of speech and then the function, and then you learn how to use a dictionary. But anyone can say it, right? But then did you really start to do it? And he's the one that told me, you know, if you want to get a higher level of Chinese, this is how you're going to have to do it. And I tell you, it's really effective because my HSK scores, they've improved a lot over the last year and then in the previous year or so when I was studying with him. And it's because of the system he gave me, because now I know how to learn Chinese.
So tell me a little bit, what do you think you gained out of that that you wouldn't have otherwise?
Yeah, honestly, every day I use the Chinese dictionary. I probably check at least 40 times. And I wouldn't have done that if he didn't tell me. And he told me, so I started to do that. And with that dictionary, the dictionary has what part of speech a certain word is. And then I look at that part of speech and I know what kind of function that word, that part of speech can have in a sentence. And then I can start to create my own sentences. So it seems basic, like, oh, you want to learn? Look it up in the dictionary. But it's all about what dictionary you learn from. And then once you use the dictionary, like, how do you use it? Do you know how to use it? Do you know what the parts of speech and what the example sentences actually are trying to communicate? And I wouldn't have got that if he didn't tell me.
In general, you know, we usually recommend, hey, you know, don't worry about studying grammar, because they're usually kind of rules that are a little bit abstract.
Yep.
And when you actually get into the situation, it's a bit hard to actually think of a rule and try to apply it.
Exactly.
And, you know, so we usually recommend, you know, having that comprehensible input, and you kind of acquire it naturally. So I'm kind of curious a little bit, you know, that's a little bit of the advice that we've kind of given a lot of some other language acquisition experts as well. But I'm kind of curious, maybe is this a skill you think is more advanced when you get to a level? Or, I mean, when would you even recommend you think someone to do this? Or what do you think is applicable?
When I started doing this, I had been learning Chinese for 5 years. And I felt very good getting around, very good communicating, very good handling nearly everything. But I got to the point where I was like, okay, do you want to stop there? Or do you want to try to get to an expert level? Do you want to try to get beyond that? Do you want to try to get ready to go to graduate school in Chinese? So most people probably don't have that ambition. You know, most people want to get around, do their business, be able to chat. And I could do all that. And it was fine. I even worked in Chinese. But when I got to that higher level, I needed something more because I had just reached a plateau. But I definitely don't recommend every person to start like looking up complex vocabulary, because I'll tell you what, it took me about a whole semester of study to really feel comfortable with this system that I learned from Mr. Zhao. It took a while. And I, in the beginning, resented as, why am I doing this? This is, I just keep practicing and I'll get more and more. And you will. But once you have this system, and once I started using the system, I could practice on my own. I didn't need to practice with other people. And I could practice less commonly used words and terms that, you know, second language learners just have trouble picking up in oral language.
That's excellent advice. I have had some people ask me before, it's like, I'm proficient. You could say the F word, I'm fluent, you know, but, you know, they want to push that higher level. And that sounds like when you get to that higher level, if you're going to push it higher, you're going to have to do some real in-depth work. And it sounds like this could be a great way to do that.
I agree, for sure.
I know you're doing in a graduate program. So, you know, what was the step? Some might say, you know, are you masochist here? I want to do a master's degree in Chinese, right? Where did this lead you? Say, hey, I want to be a teacher.
So I got to the point when I was up in Jilin and I was studying with Mr. Zhao and everything's going well. And I said to myself, where is this going? I looked myself in the mirror and I'm getting a little bit older. And I said, well, what's going to happen? And I wasn't exactly sure. And then COVID-19 came, right? So
yeah.
That threw a wrench in everything. And I saw the writing on the wall that, gosh, things are going to be different and I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it's a good time to study. So I started to apply for graduate school and I said, well, what do you want to study? Well, I want to keep studying Chinese and I want to be able to come out of this with something more than just, oh, I can speak Chinese, I'm good at Chinese, I'm fluent. I want to come out of this with something more that if someday I go back to the United States or I want to go somewhere else, I can have a piece of paper. You know, I have something that shows my level. I thought about, you know, maybe is it linguistics? Maybe is it the Chinese language, like language and literature? And after a few applications and interviews and conversations, for me, the best bet became teaching Chinese to speakers of other languages. And it's a 2-year program. And I said to myself, well, I'll apply. I'll apply for the scholarship. And if I get the scholarship, why not go for it? If I didn't get the scholarship, I said, well, maybe you're back to square one. Lo and behold, I got the scholarship. And I was accepted to go to Nanjing University.
What was that application process or admissions process like? What did you have to do to get into school?
So I had to take the HSK exam, and it was best if I could pass level 6. So I passed HSK level 6, which was big.
Which is the highest level for anyone listening. Mm-hmm. HSK 6 is like, you know, it's the bee's knees, man. There you go.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Good. Thank you. So I passed that, and then I had to do a series of small papers, you know, like we'll give you a topic and then you have to expand upon your idea. Maybe it's in the realm of Chinese language or teaching. And then finally I had interviews, just like on the phone, but your video and you have 3 professors in front of you and they say, okay, what do you think about this topic? And you have 20 minutes, you know, and I got some questions because I applied at a couple different universities.
Uh-huh.
I got some questions and I was just, you know, lost. I didn't know how to answer them. I just had to say, I don't know, because I didn't know the terminology for some of the vocabulary they were asking me about consonants and vowels. I didn't know all the beginning consonant and ending consonant in Chinese, how to say it. So I was a little lost. But each interview, I felt like I got a little bit more practice, and Nanjing University was the last one. And it was
perfect.
The most successful. So,
the more you do something, the better you get, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Tom, tell me, how do you see the future of Chinese language education? I guess specifically teaching Chinese as a foreign language. How do you see that evolving and what do you see the future of that?
There's no doubt Chinese is going to become more and more important and there'll be more and more opportunities to teach Chinese. I know in the United States we have duolingual schools and I think those are going to become more and more Chinese English. When I was growing up, I don't think I knew anyone that spoke Chinese as a second language, you know, anyone. And now I talk to my nephews and they say, oh yeah, we have Chinese as a possible third language now because they go to a dual language school. We can take it our language school, you know, like, so
oh, wow.
I see those possibilities becoming more and more. And I think Chinese is going to become more important. It already is, you know, one of the United Nations world languages, you know, so it's right up there with English and French and Russian and Arabic, you know, and Spanish. So it's already right up there and I don't see it moving.
One thing I'd like to just kind of hear from you, Tom, is like, what is it about Chinese that captured your attention and has continued to, you know, I guess, draw you deeper into the language?
I love challenges and I think Chinese has proved to be a big challenge. So that's something. And I feel like I'm always learning. I feel like I'm always learning. I've also learned other languages. You know, Chinese is my 4th foreign language. So I've learned Spanish, and I learned French, and then I learned Dendi. This language, I feel like my learning is always there. You know, when I learned Spanish and French, I felt like I kind of got to a point when I could see something and I could just automatically understand it. But with Chinese, I feel like there's always another level because it's just so different than English. So I like that. And then, you know, I'm living in China and learning Chinese. So I walk out the door and I can use it. And then I use maybe an uncommonly used phrase or a proverb or something. And these guys just love it and they laugh and they say, oh, your Chinese is so great, you know, and they just give you the flattering that, you know, everyone gets. And then the next day I go out and say ni hao to someone and then they say, oh, your Chinese is so great. And then I'm like, oh, are those guys, those guys are really flattering me. But I go outside and I get to use it. And I think that's constant stimulus. So it keeps me wanting to do more. And then sometimes I think back, like when I came in 2014, you know, and I was like, that big baby that I was just talking about, that big kid, you're just walking around, big body, but don't know anything. And I think about now, like how much I'm able to absorb, how much I'm able to take in, and how much I'm able to just think about things and reflect on things and see how things are done. And that's just such a big difference over the last 7 years. It just makes me feel good, and you want to keep doing more.
Back in 2014, that new guy in China, China noob, you know,
yeah.
If you could go back and you could give yourself some advice at that point, what would you say?
Always stay curious and then realize that every opportunity is a learning opportunity, right? Because I tell you what, when you're learning Chinese and you're a second language learner like I am, everywhere you go, you can learn. You know, the other day I was on the subway and I'm looking at the signs for the subway or the signs on the subway glass door. Wait for the person to come out and then go in, you know, like... I looked at that and there's a word there and like, how do I not know that word? I should know all these words. And you look it up and, oh, it's arbitrarily or wantonly. Like, And then the next day, you know, you're listening to the radio or cooking and watching TV and then they say it and you're like, oh, so you just see the connections. So I think we always got to stay curious, you know, and realize that there's a learning opportunity everywhere. You know, the other day, a friend had me over for dinner and after dinner, I went out and played soccer with her son and, you know, he's telling me like, oh, I'm the goalie, using Chinese and telling me, show menuan, I'm the goalie. So like, if I didn't play soccer with him, I don't watch soccer. I would never learn that word. But then now I know that word. And because we had that experience, maybe I'll forget it, but I probably won't, you know? So now I know I say the goalie. So I think that's huge, you know, just remembering that learning opportunities are everywhere, stay curious and then stay patient. You know, it's a long haul. Chinese is a long haul.
It definitely can be. What kind of advice would you give to someone who isn't in China?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I get this one often. You've got to make the language alive. So I think for some people, it's watching TV. For some people, it's listening. For some people, it's reading. For some people, it's getting a language partner online. I think we need to make the language alive because if it's just rote or boring, it's not going to work. I don't think there's a one size fits all, but you do what you think makes it alive and interesting to you. And for me in the beginning, that was talking to people because, you know, you're interacting with a human. I'm a social person. I'm outgoing. So I liked interacting with people. And so when I was in the States, you know, like I lived in Chicago for a period. It's amazing. If you know a little bit of Chinese, you might go to the gym and there's a guy right next to me and he's got on Li-Ning sandals. I'm like, oh, Nisha Jongo Rema, you're from China, right? And then he's like, oh, and then you can just start practicing, you know? So there are opportunities to use it depending where you're at. What's most important is you find a way to make it alive for you. And for some people, it's talking. Maybe it's reading. Maybe it's watching television. Maybe it's listening. Something to make it interesting.
Well, Tom, thanks so much. Hey, this has been really cool to hear your story, and thanks for taking the time to share your experience with all of us.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, gamer, traveler, investor, hiker, mason, musician, model, engineer, and that one guy named William. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Tom Connolly, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pastor. See you next time.